Being a chef means keeping your cool in the kitchen. It's up, it's up. And with Resi Priority Notify and Global Dining Access through my Amex Platinum card,
right this way,
it's nice to try someone else's food for a change. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/withAmex.
This summer, click into cordless power with Memorial Day savings at the Home Depot. Tackle more than half an acre of grass with the convenience and gas-like power of the Ryobi 40-volt battery-powered mower. And keep your flower beds looking fresh with the 40-volt cordless string trimmer. Then clear leaves and debris with the 40-volt leaf blower. No cords, no gas, no hassle. Click into Memorial Day savings happening now at the Home Depot and on homedepot.com. How doers get more done.
We're all looking for ways to save, especially on medical bills. But where do you start? Unless you're a medical bill expert, finding savings can seem impossible. Well, HealthLock can help. HealthLock is a healthcare technology company that securely connects with your insurance and flags errors like overbilling, wrong codes, and fraud. You can even have HealthLock work on your behalf to get money back from select past bills. So start saving with knowing where to look. Visit HealthLock.com today before you see another healthcare provider. That's HealthLock.com.
The Book of Job podcast is a production of iHeartRadio. Hey there, welcome back. It's the latest edition of the Book of Job podcast with me, Tom Verducci, and of course, Joe Madden. Joe, I want to get to, since we're at that point now where teams are just gathering for spring training, full squads coming in, I want to get to how important it is for a manager to set the tone literally from day one. But before we get there, we have to double back to our Super Bowl edition. It's our first show since then.
Right.
I will just go on record and remind you, Joe Madden, that I said do not give the ball to Patrick Mahomes for the last at bat in the game because he's going to beat you.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly what happened. And listen, you're a manager, Joe. You made some on the decision flies in the heat of the moment. Give me your take on Kyle Shanahan's decision to take the ball in overtime. And obviously, it didn't work out, but you rewind the tape, what were you thinking at that time?
Well, you know, that's six, one half dozen the other. I know, I get it from that perspective. By kicking off, obviously, you get to make different choices moving forward. But how about the other night I had dinner with Bruce Arians here in Tampa, and the question came up. He says, I want the ball. I want the ball. That's what VA told me the other night. So it's one of those things, when it works, it's great. When it doesn't, I would imagine, analytically speaking, there was numerical support to say that you should have kicked as opposed to receive right there. So, I, honest to God, I didn't make a whole lot of it, because if they had scored and they put the pressure on them, then it's a different the world beats differently at that point, too. But the thing I was surprised about more than anything was when I read post where a lot of the 49ers were not aware of the new overtime rules in the Super Bowl and playoffs. That kind of shocked me a little bit. I don't know if that would have made a difference. I don't know. But the fact that even the fact that they came out and so easily admitted to it, it just indicates or presents a bad picture towards the group and the organization. Shanahan's so well thought out. He is that good of a play caller. I do like watching his teams play. You're right. I did pick them in that game, and then it did come down to Mahomes at the end. So I don't know. I'm sure you have some data that might support kicking as opposed to receiving, but being in the moment right there, I'd like to know specifically, I guess they wanted to rest their defense. I heard all these different reasons. So there are different reasons to do different things.
Yeah, first of all, you're right. It is six of one, half a dozen of the other. I don't think there is a quote-unquote right way to approach the situation. If, for instance, in baseball, there used to not be an actual rule that the home team batted last. A century ago, the home team had the choice of batting first or last. And obviously, they just picked batting last every time. So they just said, you know what? We'll just make this a rule. It's an obvious choice, right? If you're tied going into the bottom of the eighth inning or top of the ninth inning, you do not have to protect the lead as a home team. It's a big advantage to go last. We see that with the extra inning rule with a runner on second base, right? If you're the home team, you know what you need to win the game. If the other team doesn't score in the top of the 10th, You can actually play for one run in the bottom of the inning. You wouldn't do that if the team scored one or two runs in the top of the inning. So what's happening is the home team has more information on which to base their decisions. That's what I didn't like about this call. You're giving the Kansas City Chiefs more information when they have the ball. If they had the ball first and have a fourth and one on their own 35, they're punting the ball. They ain't going for it. But because San Francisco put points on the board, they are going for it. And that's the play to me that won the game for them, the Mahomes keeper on fourth and short. So you're giving Kansas City more information on which to play call and to strategize. I'd rather have the information. Now, what you said is correct, though. If you score first, especially a touchdown, that puts tremendous pressure on the other team. So for me, there it can go both ways. And Shanahan's philosophy was mostly about getting the ball the third time. He thought it was a field goal game. Each team scores on field goals. Then the team that has the ball the third time is the one that has the big advantage, because now it's a sudden death situation. Field goal, you win the Super Bowl, you go home. If you're the third team that scores, he was counting on that. I don't like the idea of deferring your advantage to the third possession of overtime when you could lose and did lose on the second possession. It's like saving your closer, Joe. If you save your closer and you never get him in the game, you know, Zach Britton up in Toronto with Baltimore, you know, you look bad. You have to go down taking your best shot and taking your best swing. But analytically, yeah, I don't think there's an obvious way to go forward on this. You just know that when you see the college football game, and I get it, the rules are a little bit differently in terms of where you get the ball. Teams always defer and let the other team go first. So you have more information on which to make your decisions.
Well, that's a great breakdown, actually. And when you start bringing it to the baseball world, it makes perfect sense. Again, you're the three possession thing. I did not hear anything about that. Didn't even read anything about that, but I can understand that. I mean, again, when you're sitting down, and I would imagine that they had, at least the staff did, prior to the game being played, listen, if we get to this point, how are we going to work it?
Yeah,
and
I'm
why?
Sure they did, Joe. I'm sure the staff went through this. Whether every player got the message, I don't know, but you're absolutely right.
Yeah, and I would think this is where I would ask an analytical question. I would ask my analysts, what do you got here? Talk to me about something that I'm not seeing right here, something that I have not thought about yet, and that's really where I like analyst and analytical part of the game is like, I will do that. I will say, listen, I'm unsure here. Like there's times when you're really crystal clear and you feel strongly about it. It may go beyond any kind of number. It's just how you feel and you stay with that, whatever. But I really like the tiebreaker when I'm ambivalent. I just don't know. I really don't know. Give me more intel about this because obviously I like to really feel strongly about, we all do, about what we're going to do. And when I do feel that way, I'm going to go ahead, I'm going to plow forward. But when I don't, I want the nerds involved. And I would imagine that's what they did the day before that game.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Mm-hmm. And by the way, Joe, I want to ask you this, is again, from put your manager hat on here, decision-making. Mm-hmm. How often do you think about how the personnel on the other side influences your decision? In other words, when I'm making this decision, I have to know that it's Patrick Mahomes on the other side. This is not just an algorithm I'm trusting. I'm going against one of the best quarterbacks of all time, who's got an incredible postseason record, especially in the big moments. To me, it would seem like, you know, back in your day with the Angels or Rays, and you're going up against the Yankees, and you know Mariano Rivera is in the bullpen.
Correct.
That's just not a closer. That's the closer. How much does having Mahomes on the other side, or in my example, Mariano Rivera, affects decision-making?
Yeah, I mean, even right down to the starting pitchers. When you're facing a really good starting pitcher that's hot, you're going to take different chances early regarding where to play your defense, play your infield in, which I really got used to anyway. I started doing it almost always from the first inning on, run around third base only. So the pitcher matchup can influence, how you're going to play your defense early. And that's also going to influence risk-taking. The better the pitcher, we're facing, the more risks I want to take. It's just not logical to think that we're going to step up and hit a three-run home run, or we're going to get three line drives in the gap back to back to back. It just doesn't happen. So when the other team had a really formidable starting pitcher, I would alter defensive alignment or aggressiveness, and I would alter aggressiveness on the bases also because I really felt you had to take more chances and not play straight up. And then like you're saying, bullpen, that's when the game is a seven-inning game. Like, depends on the bullpen. I want to win after six or seven innings. That's how I would look at it. Depends on how the strength of it. especially the closer, but back it up. Again, when the Royals won it a couple years ago, my God, I mean, back it up to the fifth inning, sixth inning, because of the way they lined it up like a bunch of, 747s on the tarmac. There's just not a whole lot you can do about it. But I would do both. I would be the starting pitchers would influence defense and aggressiveness offensively, and the strength of the bullpen and a legitimate closer and setup guy. You're starting to play a seven-inning game here. You just don't want to keep waiting. So you're going to push it a little bit earlier to try to take an advantage and then hold on towards the end, because you don't want to see the significant part of their bullpen. You want to see the softer side.
Yeah, it was an enjoyable game, though, to watch the Super Bowl. Of course, decided in overtime. But even before that, watching these two quarterbacks go at it, and pretty cool that both of them are sons of professional baseball pitchers, and they're out there on a Super Bowl field competing. I just think, as I thought going into the game, when you have someone like Mahomes, and the NFL is nothing but a quarterback league, let's face it. The NFL is all about quarterback play. It's the decisive factor. There's no question about that. You saw that in the Super Bowl. I thought the one third down play, the play called by Shanahan for Brock Purdy, when, Spagnuolo is going to blitz every time in a big spot on third down, every single time. And they got caught with a play selection in which they did not account for blitz. I think you almost have to max protect and assume that Spagnuolo is going to blitz you. They got the blitz. They stop Purdy. Whereas Mahomes can improvise that one play I talked about, the fourth and one play. Was actually an option pass to Kelsey. He decides to keep the ball. It opens up. I just think Mahomes is on such a different level, Joe, that he allows play calling and playmaking that no other quarterback, and that's no knock on Brock Purdy. I mean, you saw how well he played under tremendous pressure from Jump Street. No sign of nerves at all, but you just have to put Mahomes in a different level.
Is there any league that's dominated by one position more than the NFL's dominated by one position?
No,
I mean, I'm just looking at it right here. I had brunch the other day with Raheem Morris. He's the new skipper of the Falcons. I asked, who's your quarterback, brother? I love Raheem. Raheem is one of the funnest people to hang out with, and I'm really looking forward to his success back there in Atlanta. But who's your quarterback? I mean, in baseball, it's a pitcher's league for me. I mean, I've always said that they could have named the game pitching as opposed to baseball. And the NBA, I'm just sitting here thinking, what dominates the NBA? It used to be, I thought it was a real center back in the day as we were growing up, but whether it was Chamberlain, Russell, even big old Nate Thurmond. I was a Zelmo Beatty fan for years, but each team, Bob Lindner, had to have a real aircraft carrier in the middle. I don't know that it's as necessary. These guys are shooting three-pointers now. But I think it's remained static or clear that the NFL, if you don't have a quarterback, you can't be a really smart coach. And in baseball, I'll say this. If you don't have a really good bullpen, especially at the end of it, it's really difficult to be a very good manager.
Yeah, I would agree with that, Joe. And I think if you went back to baseball in the 60s and 70s, you would stay starting pitching.
Right.
Right. But now it's obviously a game that's built from the back forward in terms of bullpen arms with so many guys with closer stuff. I'm talking about by the time you get to the fifth or sixth inning, that's what's driving the game right now. I mentioned new managers, spring training. We're going to get into that next. There are seven new managers opening up camp this week. What kind of message should they be giving their players to set the tone for the 2024 season? We'll talk to Joe about that next.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. People don't always realize just how much their negative thoughts and experiences stick with them and weigh them down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mom does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger, talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapist anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/BookofJoe today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/BookofJoe.
This is it. We've got an Amex Platinum Pro on our hands, ladies and gentlemen. We haven't seen anyone relax like this before in the Centurion Lounge. Is he connecting to complimentary Wi-Fi? Oh, my. Look at that. He is. And you will not believe where he's going next. The Amex dedicated card member entrance for the win. Unbelievable.
When you get travel perks with Amex Platinum, you're part of the action. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/withAmex.
LASIK. LASIK.com.
Have you been thinking about LASIK but not sure if you're a candidate? Just go to LASIK.com/quiz and take our free candidacy quiz. In just a few minutes, you'll know if LASIK is likely right for you. And if it is, we'll connect you with experienced LASIK doctors in your area. Start your journey towards 20/20 vision. Take our free candidacy quiz at LASIK.com/quiz. Yeah, LASIK.com. Easy to remember, so you know where to start.
LASIK, LASIK.com.
All right, Joe, I want you to go back into the memory book here and think about when you were named manager of the Tampa Bay Devil Rays at the time, excuse me. And, you know, guys, rookie managers this year, you've got Carlos Mendoza with the Mets, Stephen Vogt with the Cleveland Guardians. There's that first day speech that you probably lose a little bit of sleep over and probably is not as important as you make it out to be. I don't know how attuned players are to actually listening to a 20-minute speech or however long it is, but it does sort of set a tone. So take me back, Devil Rays, Joe Maddon, your preparation for that message that you gave, and what tone did you want to set?
You're right. You do lose sleep. I did. I'm one of those guys. I mean, I was drawing on all my years of having been a field coordinator for the Angels, a minor league manager, and even as a bench coach for so many years to get to that 2006 moment with the Devil Rays at one of my favorite sports venues of all time, Al Lang Field in St. Petersburg. That really, and I don't want to get into that too deeply, but that really, I hold that place in high regard. Yeah, you're trying to paint, you know, what you're about and what you want your team to be about. You're trying to set the culture and philosophy right from the jump street right there. And it does, it takes, it did take me a long time to try to, again, craft the words properly. And again, you have to understand your audience, like you're saying too. You can't be too long-winded. You can't get too involved, but you still want to make that point. And there's, you know, everybody else is standing there too. It's just not the players. You got GMs. You got maybe even the owners in town. You got a bunch of coaches. Maybe a lot of former major league players that are coaches now. So there's, you're addressing a lot of people, and yeah, they do want to hear what you have to say. So for me, it's all about that: setting the culture, setting the philosophy, setting the tone for the camp. Now, just moving a couple years ahead of that, or beyond that, to 2007-08, we had not, we lost 100 games and we lost near 100 games. And then here comes 2008. And I really thought I needed to be more specific or give them something to be realistic, because we had not won, I think, 70 games or something. It was like the benchmark for the Devil Rays to that point. So I was out in California and living in Brea at that time and riding my bike daily. And one day I went out there and I just pounded on something mentally to myself. I had read something about the esoteric message the Miami Heat had in their clubhouse. They used to throw a slip of paper in a bucket or something as they walked in under a towel on top of it. Just that was their intentions for the day. And I liked that that esoteric component to it. So what I did was I wrote, and I don't even know why, but I thought 9 = 8. I don't know why I did it, what I did it, but I did do it. Nine players playing 9 innings hard permits you to be one of the 8 teams in the playoffs. So I took that and I went back, and I swear I just called Andrew as soon as I got back, Friedman. I said, Andrew, what do you think about this? He said, I love it. So from that, I extrapolated. Nine more wins out of the offense, 9 more wins out of the defense, 9 more wins out of the pitching. I want each component of the game to think that we have to be 9 games better in each department, which was like obviously 27 wins, and that should put us in the playoffs that year. To the point I used to have little 9 = 8 placards above urinals in their locker room. Everywhere they looked, they saw 9 = 8, and eventually, of course, the T-shirt. And it did work. It resonated. I mean, by the end of the year, 9 = 8 was all over the Tampa Bay area. My players were actually reciting it after wins. And then eventually we got to the World Series. But that was something I thought was really dramatic or drastic that needed to be done. And how do you convince, how do you sit there, they're watching you, you're talking to your players in spring training, and you have not won more than 70 games or ever. And now all of a sudden I'm talking going to the playoffs. So I felt I had to give them an equation, a way to make this work. So that's what I did. So I sat down, and I mean, that was a bike ride. I swear I can remember it, going down Baston Cherry, up Rose, all these different streets, very hilly in Brea, really great ride. And by the time I got done, I felt pretty strongly about it, that message. And I remember the guy sitting in front of me, I remember throwing it out there, looking at they're looking at me like, what the hell are you talking about, kind of a thing. But I stayed with it. And sometimes I think that you have to create a roadmap. How are we going to do this? Just don't say we're going to do it. How are we going to do this? And that was my point. So I would try to be as specific as I could. And I think eventually it did play out pretty well.
And if I remember correctly, Joe, I think back in the day, especially the first time with the Devil Rays, that was a small gathering. Mm-hmm. It might have even been on the field where you could address your troops. You've seen it. Literally the game grow over the years. And my own experience, I went to spring training and played with the Toronto Blue Jays in 2005. We're sitting in a big room. They didn't have a great facility back then in Dunedin, but it was one after the other. It was the trainers, it was support people, it was the general manager, it was the assistant general manager, then finally it was the manager, John Gibbons. So there were a lot of voices in the room. So I think setting the tone for the manager now seems like it's a shared responsibility by an organization.
Correct. There was a time it was just the manager. There's no question about that. The manager was the voice, and that's the only voice anybody wanted to hear from. I'm not saying that was right. I was always concerned about that growing up in the Angel organization because we were changing managers so often. Philosophically, the organization was changing almost every 2 to 3 years. And as a minor league coordinator, my message to the players was always changing just based on philosophical whims. That's the best way I could describe it, of those that were in charge. There was nothing really ever etched in stone. And I think, to me, that's why the Angels floundered a lot coming up, because we had great players, man. I think it's been said that we were documented. We put more guys into big leagues between 84 and 94 than any other organization in baseball, but we could not win on the major league level until eventually we did. So, yeah, all that stuff is important and it matters. And right now, for instance, I'm thinking when you brought that up, I'm remembering Sloan Park Cubs. There's this big meeting room, theater room. It's almost like a lecture hall in a university. And I'm standing down there and it's like everybody's like, you know, piled up one seat next row higher than the other. This place is packed. I mean, every seat's taken, everybody standing along the walls, upside and back. It's a claustrophobic feeling to it. And you got to go in there and throw your stuff out at them. And like I said, it wasn't just me. It starts with, I think, Mr. Ricketts spoke, and then, of course, Theo spoke, Crane Kenny spoke, everybody spoke, and then you speak. It's intimidating. I'm not going to lie to you, man. It's intimidating. There's a lot of stuff going on there, and it's completely different because there was only one message that mattered from, I don't know, the beginning of time until, I don't know, was it 2015. I don't even know when it really changed, but I'm here to tell you, man, when Gene Mock stood in front of you, that's all I had to hear. Johnny McNamara, Doug Rader, Marcel Lachman. There was no other voice that was pertinent at that time. And it was the same in every other organization.
Yeah. I mean, you're right. You think about that meeting room and Sloan at the training complex there that the Cubs have, it's beautiful. And it sort of, to me, is emblematic of the growth of the game, both in terms of the front office size, in terms of the staffing and all the different components that go into building a team. And, you know, I was sitting on basically grammar school desks with the Blue Jays back in their old training facility in Dunedin. So all these places have great facilities. As I mentioned, Joe, there's 7 managers with new teams, 2 rookie managers that I mentioned. All of them, I don't care if you're Bob Melvin, you've been around for 20-something years. There's got to be kind of an anxiety, maybe not a nervousness, but, you know, wanting to get off on the right foot, introduce yourself to the players, the ones that you don't know, in which case it's probably a lot. I'll go back to my favorite story about managers' first day meetings or first full workout is usually when they have them. Joe Torre in 1996. Here's a guy who's never been to the World Series as a player or as a manager. He gets hired to replace Buck Showalter. He knows he's got a good team, and he stands up there, and he's setting the goal. And the goal is not to win the World Series. Remember, the Yankees at that point had not been to a World Series since 1978. That's an eternity in Yankee Kingdom. Joe Torre gets up there, and he says, I want to win a World Series, and not just one. I want to win multiple World Series. And I think that, in its own way, set the tone. It was something that was very personal. Here's a guy just... he spent his whole baseball life trying to get to the World Series and hadn't been there. And he's not satisfied with even getting there once. He wants multiple ones. And of course, the Yankees go off on a dynasty in the Torre era. Anything like that stand out for you, Joe, or one of your speeches or someone when you were a coach and you thought, man, that just hit the right tone for a season?
Well, yeah, I really do. I mean, the 9 = 8 thing, I'm serious. I mean, think about it. We had the Rays, the Devil Rays, were nothing. I mean, it was a organization. It was not a good organization. There was a lot of infighting. There was not one method of doing anything and kind of like searching for your footing. And I thought it was really important that we, and then of course, at that point, I had to come up with a thought or something to make it believable, predictable. It can actually happen. And then just to take it to another level, I know when I went to Chicago with the Cubs, that first press conference at the Cubby Bear, and I could see my name in the marquee out the window at Wrigley Field, that I'm going to start talking playoffs, or I'm going to start talking World Series. And that was the first thing I said with the Cubs when I walked in the door there also. I know with the Angels more recently and with the Devil Rays, I talked playoffs, but I think pretty certain I was more specific with the World Series with the Cubs when I got there in 2014-15, moving on from there. So, yeah, you have to be – listen, it's a self-fulfilling whatever. Whatever comes out of – if trepidation comes out, if uncertainty comes out in those talks or thoughts or speeches, that's what the players are going to carry with them. You have to aim high, and you have to make sure that you're creating within the player or whomever else is listening this wanting to set some high bars here. Let's set some expectations. That's the other thing. You've heard me talk about expectations and pressure. Everybody talks about it as being a privilege. Great. But I talk about it as, if you see those words, run towards them. Never run away from pressure and expectations, because those words have really good conclusions attached to them. And that was always a big part of whenever I talk to my guys, to really point that out. Because, I mean, so many times, you did mention the word anxiety. And I prefer eagerness. When you get to those moments, and we have all had these moments where things get, you're counted on, you're put out front, you're the lead singer, you're setting the tone. And there's an anxiousness, there's an anxiety. I cannot deny that. But I try to channel it into eagerness. Eager is a better word than being anxious for me. So I really try to focus on that from my perspective and realize when I get all amped up like that, I'm just more eager than nervous or anxious. And it's easier for me to deal with it internally. Because believe me, man, everybody, there's a lot of folks, and myself included, that can look like like a calm sea on the surface from a distance. But I'll tell you what, if you can see below the surface, there's a lot of paddling going on, and there's a lot of uncertainty going on underneath there that it really does mess with your head a little bit. So I prefer the word eager over anxious or anxiety. And I also believe in admitting to it. There's a great line that I read years ago, feel the fear and do it anyway. I think Sue, was it Grafton? I think she wrote the book, something like that. But feel the fear and do it anyway. We're all confronted with that. That's that uncomfortable moment. And if you want to be great, you have to face your uncomfortable moments.
Well, I'm glad you said, establish expectations and don't be afraid of identifying them. Dave Roberts, a couple of years ago, took some heat because he said, we're going to win the World Series. Well, what's he supposed to say? You know, if you want to be politically correct, you say, well, I think we have a chance to play meaningful games in September.
I hate
no,
that. I freaking hate that.
You're there to that. Win. And we've seen a lot of teams win the World Series, all the way back to last year. Anybody thinking about the Texas Rangers as a World Series champion? I guarantee you Bruce Bochy was. But just because the rest of the world doesn't, don't settle for just, hey, we want to play meaningful games in September. No, go ahead and aim high. This is why you're there. This is why you play these games. And do I think the Oakland A's have a chance to win the World Series this year? No, that's not really what I'm talking about. I'm talking about teams that are competitive. You have a pretty good ball club. Why not talk about winning the World Series? That's why you're there, folks.
If it comes out of your mouth, you got a chance to have it done. If it doesn't come out, I've always felt that. I mean, I've said some things, you know, and I get out there a little bit sometimes. But I always, I don't know, weirdly, historically, I'm, from a personal perspective, if I say it, it has a much better chance of it coming to fruition or becoming true. And if I just hold it inside, it just continues to percolate or fester, whatever you want to call it. But don't be afraid to make proclamations in that regard. And again, like you're saying, it's over the top. I mean, yeah, you have to temper that a bit. But even, listen, brother, if I'm running the Oakland A's, I'm going to try to convince these guys somehow in that spring training. I'm not talking meaningful games in September, because that's another easy out for me. That is executive talk right there. I want to play playoff games in September, October, November. I want to play playoff games. So in some way, you're right. Oakland would be an unrealistic. There's certain teams that would be unreal. I get that. But somehow I'd want to convince them that if everything were to break right, we have a shot to get to the playoffs. And I got to get them aiming high, man, because if they don't, we're just going to be – you're going to have this awful record in the middle of May, June, July, August. And it's tough. It's tough going to the ballpark under those circumstances. It's very difficult.
Real quick, Joe, if Stephen Vogt or Carlos Mendoza asked you, what am I in for as a rookie manager? And think about Vogt. He just stopped playing 2 years ago. You know, he had 1 year of coaching. He's got Carlos Albernez as his bench coach. He's got the veteran Carl Willis as his pitching coach. And then you have Carlos Mendoza with the New York Mets, who has some years coaching under Aaron Boone with the Yankees. What do you think, when they look back on their rookie season, will strike them as something that maybe was different or most challenging about being a rookie manager in the big leagues?
Well, let me go Vogt first. I think it's going to be quick in the beginning because he's never really done this, whereas Mendoza has. I mean, as a bench coach, Mendoza's had to process the game from that step to be an advisor to manager of the New York Yankees. So he's got some decent background right there. I mean, I'm just, you know, my personal level, when I became a manager, I'd already been there for Marcel and Terry Collins and Soch for years. And before that, you know, I'd run an organization. I'd run the minor league system for a long time. So there's an ability to slow things down. Now, even though Vogt had been a player, and I get it, and he played a long time and he played well, it's different when you're in there trying to decide, make decisions for, and be ahead of the process always on a nightly basis in a very fast major league game. Again, from up top, it is kind of like a nice slow dance. When you're in the dugout, it's almost like that beginning of Star Trek when the Enterprise just becomes a blur and runs out of sight. There's two different methods or speeds to the game. So I think the quickness of the game as a manager, a thinking opponent of the game, Albie and him are going to have to figure that out. And on Mendoza's side, I mean, I read a lot what he says. The guy is he's got away with words. He's pretty bright, and he's also he's well thought out. That's what I'm getting from my read about his positivity, and the different attributes that I think that turned Stearns on, and led him to this particular moment. For him, I just think it's going to be when crap hits the fan for the first time, that he's able to stay with his philosophies, his thoughts, his methods. He talks a lot about trust and building relationships. He talks about that a lot, which I love. So for him, I think it's going to be this first New York, crap hits the fan. Things aren't working like we had talked about. Being able to stay with this message is going to be very important, where I think Voter and that group, on the other hand, I don't know that the expectations are nearly as high, and he's working off Broadway. I just think the quickness of the game, he needs to get a handle on that, and then he's going to be just fine.
Hey, we want to talk also about the news we always generates this time of year in spring training. When the stars report to camp, and most news media people haven't seen them, spoken to them for a few months, so no matter what they say, they tend to generate a headline. That certainly was the case with Mike Trout. And I want to ask Joe about Mike Trout and Shohei Ohtani and the futures ahead of both of those guys right after this.
There's no distance too far for the perfect trip.
Hi, checking in for...
Or the perfect table.
Hey, where are you?
Coming!
And when you get access to Resi Priority Notify with your Amex Platinum card...
Hey, this looks amazing!
I'm so glad you made it.
and travel benefits at fine hotels and resorts booked through Amex Travel, it's worth the trip. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/withAmex.
LASIK. LASIK.com.
Have you been thinking about LASIK but not sure if you're a candidate? Just go to LASIK.com/quiz and take our free candidacy quiz. In just a few minutes, you'll know if LASIK is likely right for you. And if it is, we'll connect you with experienced LASIK doctors in your area. Start your journey towards 20/20 vision. Take our free candidacy quiz at LASIK.com/quiz. Yeah, LASIK.com. Easy to remember, so you know where to start.
LASIK, LASIK.com.
Are you still searching for your perfect place to call home? Well, now is the time to buy at Fisher Homes. If you're looking to move in before the end of 2024, May could be your last opportunity to start building your dream home and close before the year's end. If you're hoping to move in even sooner, Fisher Homes also has homes that are move-in ready and waiting for you, where you can start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with a new home advisor today at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home.
Well, Joe, let's talk about a couple of your former players, Shohei Ohtani and Mike Trout. First, Shohei, obviously not pitching this year as he rehabs from Tommy John surgery. I've been amazed, Joe, at how much better Shohei has gotten as a hitter at the big league level while pitching. You know, last year made 23 starts. I thought that was his best offensive season ever. He has become the best fastball hitter in the big leagues. He had a little bit of trouble with that early in his career, especially on the ball up and in. So I see a guy on a trajectory straight up offensively. And now I'm thinking in that lineup and not having, you know, the game prep as a pitcher and throw in the recovery as well. I mean, Joe, it could be scary, the kind of numbers that he put up. He won a home run title last year with 44, and he essentially barely played in the last 3 weeks of the season. Give me your thoughts on Shohei now that he will be dedicated only to hitting. I know he did that before after his first Tommy John surgery, but I think he's a much better hitter now when he first got to the big leagues.
Well, first off, mechanically, I think he's better. I mean, when I saw him when I first got there in 2020, he was spinning off everything. And he was coming off of surgery, and things weren't really back to where they had been. So I never saw him really good when he first got to the Angels, and I saw him not so good with the Angels. Then I saw him like, wow. So first of all, I think his hitting mechanics, his balance, got much better over the last couple of years. That's what I've seen. And you nailed it right there, high ball. This boy can hit a high ball, man. He hits a high ball well. You can't throw an elevated fastball by him. He'll get on top of it. He'll look for it. He won't miss it. And it's going to go far. So I think the better balance in his swing last several years, I think the ability to really handle the ball up and, like you're saying, up and in, you can't go there because he's so smart. If he thinks you're going to go there, and you will, the big thing is not only to look for it and there it is, but you can't take it, miss it, foul it off, whatever. You got to hit it hard and keep it fair, which he does. And the last point, what I've noticed is more off field. I think he's more wanting to or able to just poke the ball to the left side when it's necessary to move the ball. And maybe drive in a point and be much more of a pain in the butt because he likes to run the bases. He likes to get out there and be on the bases. He likes that too. He plays a complete game. So dangerous because of all those different reasons, better balance, kills the high ball, which is that's part of a game right now. And now he knows if the changeup something soft in a way, I could go the other way. He's got all of that in the playbook right now. And like you said, with the I thought about this a little bit, the fact that I don't know to what extent pitching balanced out this need to just hit all the time. So is he going to miss that? Is he going to miss that workout and going out and pitching? Is it a way to park the mind a little bit to not become too obsessed with your hitting? So I'm just curious if he gets overly obsessed with the hitting and misses the balance in his game. It's kind of like him playing defense. He's not a defensive player. I'd even be curious if they're going to put him on defense at some point this year. I would be. Like if something were to break down on the Dodgers, would they actually put him on defense in the outfield if they need to? You don't think so?
No, they won't. But if for whatever reason, if he has trouble rehabbing and next year is not the same pitcher, absolutely, he becomes an option to play the outfield. I mean, this guy's such a good athlete. When he was first drafted by the Fighters, they talked about him playing shortstop.
I could see it.
True story. It's an interesting point you make, though, Joe, about now just dedicated to hitting. Because I've always said, you know this, I've said this to you, the best thing about Shohei is he wants to be a two-way player. This is in his heart. And the American way is to specialize. And for years and years, people have said, oh, just imagine if he was just a pitcher, how good he'd be. Or, oh, just imagine if he just concentrated on hitting, how good he would be. I think doing both brings out the best in Shohei Ohtani. So it's an interesting point you make about now just being a full-time hitter. And listen, he'll be doing all his rehab work, and at some point he's on a throwing program. It's not like he's just not throwing, but as far as game-ready pitching, that's not part of his mindset this year. And I agree. I think he'll miss it a lot.
I do. I mean, he likes to be doing things. You don't see him a lot out there because he likes to do things underneath. He's good in the cage. He loves in the cage. He'll get his workouts on the mound done at a good hour away from the maddening crowd because he just has to be. I mean, he's the Beatles, man. He gets inundated. He's all four of them wrapped into one. And so he likes to do his work on his own, which I understand. I would just watch this play out. I don't know that it's a slam dunk, that just hitting's going to be a difference maker. You know, theoretically it sounds that way, but I like you said, I know how much he likes to pitch, and he likes the competitive part of pitching. And like I said, it's good to park your mind sometimes and not just get obsessed with one thing. And let's just see how it plays out. He might just nail it. Of course, he just might nail it because that's who he is. But then again, he might miss it so much or become so lopsided in his game when it doesn't go well with his hitting. He doesn't have his pitching to fall back onto right now.
Yeah, I would bet on him having a big year, though, given his talent and the fact that now he's playing on a team, let's face it, that's going to the playoffs, and he knows that from day one. This is what he wants. This is the environment he wants. And by the way, if you're drafting fantasy league players, take Will Smith because he's a .295 career hitter with runners in scoring position. I've seen him do it many times. He uses the whole field with runners out there, more of a pull hitter with bases empty. And now he's got Mookie Betts, Freddie Freeman, and Shohei Ohtani in front of him. Not only are they on base all the time, all of them are excellent base runners. I mean, excellent. I mean, top 10% type base runners. So if you're Will Smith, man, traffic all year long.
I never quite understood why he didn't catch more earlier, Smith. I know Barnes has got, he's got his reputation and some of the pitchers like to throw to him, and I didn't watch Smith closely enough to know how good or bad, but I thought he threw well. But I like this guy's swing a lot. This guy can flat hit. I saw him as being a pretty darn good catcher. I don't know if they were just trying to bring him along slowly or if some of the pitchers were clamoring for Barnes to catch. But this guy here, nobody talks about him enough as being one of the top catchers in baseball, but I think he is.
Now let's talk about Mike Trout, because Joe, you and I have talked about this a lot. One of the most overrated narratives that's been going on the last couple of years is that the Angels should trade Mike Trout. Mike Trout's not going anywhere, folks. We've been saying that for years. If you know Mike Trout a little bit, you know he is one loyal cat. He's not the kind of guy to rock the boat. He's not the kind of guy who's going to put himself above an organization that drafted him when 22 other teams didn't draft him, that gave him the biggest extension in baseball, a 12-year contract. You said it well, Joe. He's a people pleaser. He wants to please the people around him, whether it's family or whether it's Artie Moreno, whether it's Angels fans. He is not going to rock the boat. And people love to write, oh, Mike Trout's got to get out of here. He's got to force a trade. So, of course, Mike Trout shows up again in spring training, this time without Shohei Ohtani for the first time in 7 years. And the question is about demanding a trade. And Mike again said, I think the easy way out is to ask for a trade. Mike is not the kind of guy to take an easy way out. Is he frustrated? Of course he is. Does he want to win? Of course he is. The second worst narrative is that Mike Trout is happy each year the Angels not going to the playoffs, collecting his paycheck. No, it eats at him. But what he wants to do is win with the team that he's loyal to. It's that simple, and people have a hard time understanding that, Joey. I mean, Mike, you don't get any pretenses with him. He's going to tell you the way that it is, and I think the mistake of a lot of people in the media and fans is to try to find other intentions or agendas for Mike Trout. They're not there.
No, he is who he is. We've talked about this, too, and in a very minute way, could identify with him being from the part of the world that he's from, how he was raised, the town that he had been raised in, you know, his family, his parents, et cetera. A very, very similar background. And to it'd be it's so antithetical, abhorrent to think that I would demand anything and he would not demand anything, like when it comes to an organization to trade me or whatever the demands might be. I would say this, though. I think that if the Angels traded him, of course he would go willingly at that particular juncture, but he'll never demand a trade. And I'm not saying that he wants one, like you said. I don't say that. But I thought they would have traded him. I did after, like I said, Shohei did not sign. And I thought at that particular juncture, you still want to get as much as you can out of Mike as you're trying to rebuild it or build the situation, not even rebuild it, build it. So I thought that was kind of curious because we talked about that. If Shohei does not sign back with the Angels, I thought that at that point they should consider trading Michael. And we talked about that also last trade deadline when they chose to not trade Shohei and what that meant to the organization moving forward also. So there's all this other subplot about this. But then again, when you look at some of the young players, they got some nice young players coming to camp again. They have to augment their pitching, although there's a lot to like. I mean, I like some of their young pitchers. I was there with these guys. I like these kids a lot. So at the end of the day, I'm getting off track. But with Trouty, he's there. He wants to be there. I agree with that. They do need to build around him a little bit more. I don't know how they're going to – you can't replace Shohei. You cannot replace him. So it's just going to have to be a different method they're going to have to incorporate in order to get back to 500 and beyond. But as far as Mikey's concerned, he'd be very happy to stay there for the rest of his career.
Yeah, and Joe, you and I know Artie Moreno is not trading Mike Trout. Come on. Artie Moreno, you can attack whether he knows how to win the right way and build a team around Mike Trout, but he is there. I truly believe it's almost like an old school type of owner. It matters to him about the attendance, about the way fans and especially families view his team. Mm-hmm. And Mike Trout is extremely popular in Anaheim. And this is a guy who's every day, I mean, literally every day you've seen it. He's out there signing autographs for kids before a game. He is the definition of a franchise player. Mm-hmm. The value that Mike Trout has as the face of the franchise is enormous. And I think Artie Moreno is one of those owners, and not all think this way, who truly values it's worth having that tentpole player like Mike Trout. So Mike Trout is not getting traded by Artie Moreno.
You're right. I mean, I'm not denying that. I'm just being like, just if you were the GM there, if I was the GM there, whatever. How would you approach that independent of what the owner was thinking? I mean, what kind of thoughts would you bring to the owner regarding not to try to get beyond just being this, you know, this major league team in Southern California that has this reputation where Mike Trout is my centerpiece? How do we get beyond that to the point where we're just beyond just appearances? We're here to try to really win this whole thing, and what it would take to do that, and what kind of return would you get for somebody like this? And I'm sure they have to have had explored all the options with something like that. But that's it. I mean, I'm just if being the in that position where you're trying to build a World Series winning team, what would you actually do under those circumstances?
Yeah, well, let's talk about that. First of all, they need Mike Trout to stay healthy. There's no question right. about that. Mm-hmm. Mike Trout hasn't had 500 at-bats in the season since he was 25 years old. Mm-hmm. Think about that. He's missed 33% of the Angels games over 7 years. I want to see Mike Trout play a full season because I've said this, Joe. He becomes a more dangerous power hitter as he ages. There's no question about that. He has learned the ability to get the ball in the air, especially to pull side in the right times. And it's typical of great hitters. Usually the power quotient goes up as they age. And I think he's a 40 to 50 home run guy, if not more, if you give him a full season. Now, he has said he has gone to John Carpino and Artie Moreno and pushed for them to sign more players. And I get that. It just because I said Mike Trout's not being traded doesn't mean he's not behind the scenes saying, go out there and sign these players. Here's my question, Joe. If you're Artie Moreno, or you might put the Boston Red Sox in this category as well, maybe even the Chicago Cubs. You know, Scott Boras still has his clients out there. You know, he's got five of the best free agents. He's got four of the top eight free agents that are still out there. Blake Snell, Cody Bellinger, Matt Chapman, and who's the other one I'm forgetting here? Jordan Montgomery. Mm-hmm. He's got impact players. Say, you know, if you're the Angels, and right now you look like a, you know, probably at best a 500 team, maybe a little bit below. Can you go out there and sign Blake Snell and Cody Bellinger and now think you're going to the playoffs with Mike Trout? or if you're the Boston Red Sox, right now on paper, you look like the last place team in the AL East. You signed two of those pitchers, Snell and Montgomery. Are you all of a sudden now going to the postseason? It's a very interesting dynamic, Joe, to have these top free agent players still out there after camps open. I'm not talking about one or two, but a whole bunch of them who could be difference makers. So that's the question for me, Joe, is if you're Artie Moreno and you've made some mistakes on huge contracts in the past that haven't worked out, is it worth it to try to go for that brass ring where you're not really a playoff team right now, but did two of those players, not one, put you in the mix, and what's the cost of that?
Well, you know, first of all, I mean, I don't see that Artie succumbing to the pressure of even the superstars asking him to sign particular players. I don't see that being part of the landscape there. That's not what I necessarily saw at that time. Artie would have to be motivated on his own to want to get those things done. When it comes down to these players that are available, from my perspective, heck yeah. I mean, if I have a pretty nice looking ball club and I got pitchers of that caliber, and I know, you know, Snell, Cy Young, I get it. There's going to be, you have to have a pretty strong and formidable bullpen to augment the innings that have to be pitched when he's starting. Listen, the stuff is that good. I've seen this guy. I've only seen him good. I have not seen him bad. And so that stuff is prodigious. And he is all of that. It's just a matter of him somehow getting more deeply into the game, or you being able to support him from the backside. Montgomery, on the other hand, there's another guy. I was not shocked that he did so well with Texas. I was kind of shocked that the Yankees thought so little of him, you know, what I had read about after they had let him go. But yeah, these two guys on being signed by a team that does a decent or legitimate team on the field, position player wise, that just needs to augment their pitching staff. This could be it could be a game changer regarding that. The Red Sox, they just signed somebody. Who did the Red Sox just sign? I saw that.
They got Liam Hendricks on a 2-year deal, but he's be rehabbing 1 year.
Okay. Is that right? That's 1 year of that. So I don't know. I mean, yeah, these guys can make a difference, but when it comes to the Angels, I just don't see it happening there. I don't see Artie going out and spending money on all those, at least two of those guys.
You're probably right. I mean, listen, the Angels, they've spent a lot of money, but under Artie Moreno, they've gone over the first luxury tax threshold once, and that was like an accounting error by like 22 cents. And last year, they did incredible financial gymnastics, moving players to get under the threshold. So does he all of a sudden change routine with a 74 to 82 win team and go for it now? Probably not. But it's interesting to see how things are going to play out with, it's very unusual to have this many top free agents. There's always one or two maybe, but Scott Boras is sitting on five of them right here. And he promises they'll be ready to go, hitting the ground running, and will not be behind schedule. We'll see. And speaking of prodigious stuff, Joe, I always think about you as our closer with prodigious stuff. Mm. Taking us out today, I wonder what you have in mind.
Well, it was about decision making. How about that?
I love it.
I was, I had two that I was stuck on, and I couldn't really decide on one. One is from an author that I really enjoyed reading, Malcolm Gladwell, whether it was Blink. It was probably my favorite by him. But he said, truly successful decision-making relies on a balance between deliberate and instinctive thinking. We've talked about that, but it's so succinct and it's appropriate and it's right on. And then the Lionel Messi, the soccer dude, right?
Right.
And this guy's pretty good from what I understand. I'm not a soccer guy, but the best decisions aren't made with your mind, but with your instinct. So does that mean that the analytical world has not overtaken the soccer world yet? But again, you're talking about deliberate and instinctive thinking, and then Messi's talking about the best decisions aren't with your mind, your instinct. I've always thought I always think with three body parts, and that would be my mind, my heart, and my stomach, my gut. And sometimes everybody always wants to think that it's wise to choose and make decisions based on what you're thinking. But believe me, man, I think there's times when the heart matters and definitely where the gut matters. I mean, probably the gut to me is the most accurate decision maker that there is. And then I could argue over number two between the heart and the mind. I'm not sure there. Probably the heart being the least reliable just because emotions get in the way. But man, if you don't follow your instincts, brother, you're gonna miss out on a lot of good situations.
Joe, that sounds like really good advice for Stephen Vogt and Carlos Mendoza. You know, Gut is not a dirty word. If you explain yourself after a game on a decision that didn't work out, and part of it is using your experience in this game, and both these guys, either as players or coaches, have a ton of it, why not rely on that and sort of admit to it that this was my most well-informed decision? It's, as you said, a balance of the numbers and the gut.
Tom, you just nailed it, man. Gut is not a dirty word. Wow. You talk about a T-shirt. That should be the first Book of Joe T-shirt. Got the Book of Joe thing on the front, but on the back. Gut, not the gut. Is it the gut is not a dirty word, or gut is not a dirty word?
I love it.
That's awesome. Brother,
yeah.
That might be, that's for your next book right there. That's awesome.
Or at least my next T-shirt.
Well done.
Always a pleasure, Joe. Thanks.
Same here, buddy. Thank you.
The Book of Joe podcast is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. It's a simple truth. No matter who you are, mental health challenges can affect you, and how you manage them can make all the difference. That's why everyone should have access to mental health support that meets them where they are and helps them get through. BetterHelp provides online therapy on your schedule. It's flexible, simple to use, and more affordable than in-person therapy. Connect with a licensed therapist selected just for you. Learn more at BetterHelp.com. That's BetterHelp.com.
There's no distance too far for the perfect trip.
Hi, checking in for...
Or the perfect table.
Hey, where are you?
Coming!
And when you get access to Resi Priority Notify with your Amex Platinum card...
Hey, this looks amazing.
I'm so glad you made it.
And travel benefits at fine hotels and resorts booked through Amex Travel. It's worth the trip. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/withAmex.
Are you still searching for your perfect place to call home? Well, now is the time to buy at Fisher Homes. If you're looking to move in before the end of 2024, May could be your last opportunity to start building your dream home and close before the year's end. If you're hoping to move in even sooner, Fisher Homes also has homes that are move-in ready and waiting for you, where you can start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with a new home advisor today at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home.